We've been looking at David's reign over Israel, and in our last study, we looked at Absalom. We were looking kind of at the end of his attempted coup, if you will, to take the kingdom away from David. We got into the end of that, we noted in chapter 18, we began to look at the end of Absalom's life, and that's where we're going to pick up this evening. Absalom is, of course, killed in this massive battle, the civil war that is going on in chapter 18. We'll continue to look at that. We'll also look at David's return, eventual return to Jerusalem. And as he comes back, David offers pardon to some of those who, did him wrong as he left. A couple of those interesting interactions. We'll note David's repaying of a debt to someone who had helped him while he was forced to flee. We will, depending on how far we get, but we're going to look at maybe some fractures in the nation that have begun to show themselves. And this is important as we look forward to kind of note how things are changing among the people of God. A second rebellion then begins to happen. So David goes from having to run away from Absalom to another man who tries to conspire against him. David will, after that settled down, David will avenge the Gibeonites. He'll avenge them for some wrong that Saul had done to them. War then will break out with the Philistines, and David's men will handle that. Then we'll see, just real briefly, some of this we're going to go through really quickly, so I'm just noting some of what's happening here. David will give a song of deliverance, and then in chapter 23, we note some of the final words of David as we get near the end of the book here, and then David takes an ill-advised census of the people, and we'll note that. Now, like I said, I know it seems like a lot. Some of that's going to be real brief. Some of it we'll get into more detail. But I do want to go back, and I want to go back to Absalom in chapter 18 in verse 33. If we go back to chapter 18, earlier, if we back up to verse 9, what happens? So you have Absalom is on this mule, and the writer here doesn't give us great detail to what happened. We could maybe speculate, but I don't want to do a lot of that. But somehow, Absalom, the donkey forces Absalom underneath this tree, and he gets hung in this tree. And the kind of implication I understand from this is Absalom's in a situation where he's kind of incapacitated. He can't do anything about it. We then see a Cushite man who sees Absalom. He brings word to Joab. What's Joab's response? Do you remember what we said? Joab's like, well, did you kill him? And I'm paraphrasing, but basically he asked him, why didn't you kill him? What's the Cushite man's response? I don't know why I'm having trouble with that word. But what's his response? All right, this is the part where I ask, and then y'all give me some. He says what?
He says no.
He says no.
David didn't want him to be killed.
Yeah, so the Cushite man says, I heard what David said. He said, don't harm my son. And so he says, I'm not going to do this. It's funny because Joab offers to pay him. He said, I would have given you silver and a new belt. And then what's the Cushite man's response? If you'd given me 1,000 silver pieces, I wouldn't have done it. And so then Joab, being a man of action, What does he do? Well, he goes over, he picks up three spears and stabs him in the heart. Then he has his 10 young men come over and they basically brutally kill Absalom. So now Absalom's dead. And then as we ended last week, we noted how first Absalom's brother wants to go and tell David. He says, don't do that. You won't get any reward for telling him this news. I think Joab knows how David's going to react. So he sends the Cushite man. He says, you go and tell him what you've seen. Well, he runs. Well, Joab's brother's like, I need to go. And so he says, go. And it's interesting, the scripture tells us, he goes and outruns the other guy. He's so interested in getting to David. He's so excited to go tell David what happened. He outruns him, gets to David, says, we've won the day. We've won the day. Now, what did his brother not know? He didn't know about Absalom's death. He says, there was some commotion over there. I'm not sure what happened. And so that's the first piece of news he got, which is, we've won. Now, David's response should be excited. And maybe he is at the first, but then the Cushite man comes. And what does he tell him? Basically, he tells him, he's been treated as your enemy. He's been repaid the evil that he did to you. And what's David's response? Go to verse 33 up here. David cries out what? It says, verse 33, that he was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. Right, he is torn up. Now, you could speculate and spend some time about what his deep grief, what's in behind that, what's motivating that. There's probably some different ideas, emotions playing in his mind. Maybe there's guilt over him knowing that he kind of pushed Absalom in this direction. Maybe it's just simply, my son has died. I mean, this is awful. Any number of reasons he might have given, but you can see the depth of his despair. But David's king, isn't he? So he's got to think about more than himself. What did David lose sight of that Joab's going to remind him about? What did he lose sight of? As you think about that, let's go on to chapter 19. Chapter 19 and verse 1 and 2. So, somebody comes to Joab. What do they say? They see what the king's doing. What do they go to Joab and say? Verse 1. He's mourning, right? Now, how does that change the atmosphere among David's men? Do you remember what it said in verse 3? We'll come back to that in just a second. But what does it say in verse 3? They stole into the city. What does that mean? They stole into the city. They what? They snuck back in. You know, what does a thief do when he's trying to steal from you? Does he come in with a trumpet sounding out, I'm here to take your TV? Is that what they do?
No, they sneak in.
They try to come in unnoticed. When it says they stole into the city, here are a group of men who just won this great victory, but they're not coming back as victors. I mean, can you imagine, after the, we got the NCAA basketball championships going on right now. Can you imagine the team who wins this? After the game's over, all of them like, oh, we won. Right? Is that how they react? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Because obviously he's his son. But he also knows that ultimately this goes back to what he did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was told by Nathan that, hey, the good times are over, dude. And so he knows that part of what's going on is because of what he did. But you make a good point, and, well, you know, that's great. We're sorry your son died, but you're the king, so act like it.
Yeah, and he's going to have to move on beyond this. And if we go back, so in verse 2, notice this. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard that day, the king is grieving over his son. So the people have reacted. They've seen what David's doing. Well, what's Joab's reaction? Joab came into the house to the king and said, "You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines, because you loved those who hate you and hate those who love you. For you have made it clear today that the commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased." That's some tough words. What's Joab's point to him? What did we go out to battle for? We went out to win. We went out to take Absalom off the throne so that you can be put back on. And look at how you're reacting to it. Verse 7. And then he gives him some pretty sobering advice, or a warning, if you will. "Now therefore arise and go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." What's Joab saying to him? What's his... You got to pull it together. He's taking all the passion out of the people. They're more confused now than they were before. You know, I hear people talk about sometimes about this war in Ukraine, and some of what this is, some people commentating on it, is a lot of the soldiers, even among the Russians, don't know why they're there. And maybe that's why they're not winning like they thought they would. It's hard to win something you don't really understand why you're doing it. I'll give you a funny example. I think about the Karate Kid. Anybody ever watch Karate Kid? I'm not the only one, right? You watch that movie, and Miyagi has Daniel-san out there, and he's painting the fence, right? Stain the fence. Huh, damn, right? He has waxed the car, right? Big circles, you remember, and he's got him on there. Sand the floor. What's his point? And so Daniel's like, at one point, he's like, "What am I doing? I'm just here. I'm just your servant." I'm kind of paraphrasing there, but he's yelling at him. Why is he doing that? Well, he doesn't understand. And so Miyagi ends up showing him what he's doing. He's teaching him, instinctual habits that he'll need when he's fighting. People need to understand what they're fighting for. And all that got lost in all of this. And so Joab's point is, you need to go to them. And you need to tell them why they're fighting. And you need to show them kindness. And it's interesting. I think Joab saw this coming. That's why he told his brother, "Don't go. You're not going to get a reward out of telling him that we won." Because I think he feared how David would react. Now, is David's grief real? Absolutely. Is it appropriate even to grieve? Sure, but not in the way he's doing it. He's bigger than just a man at this moment. He's king. And he's not responsible for just himself, but for all those men who fought for him. And so he says, you need to go. In verse 8, he says, David listened. That's one of the things I love about David. We can give him a hard time. He made mistakes. So do I. Thank God for his mercy and grace, right? But when he hears good advice, most often he responds in the right way. He's humble enough to admit defeat. That's one of the things I think that really trips Saul up. I think Saul was an intelligent man, but I think Saul's pride would not allow him to admit mistakes that he'd made. That's not true with David. David's made some big mistakes, just like Saul. But the difference that you see over and over again is when David hears truth, he can stop and say, you know what? You're right. I'm wrong. And he repents. He changes. What does he do? He goes out. He sits down in the gate, which is kind of language for he's out among the people. He's holding open conference with the people where they can come up to him and they can talk to him and he can say, thank you. Thank you for how hard you fought. Thank you for the victory today. Even though he's grieving inside, the mourning didn't go away. He's not all of a sudden happy. He's still in mourning, but he's able to overcome. You see it all the time at funerals. I do. I notice this. You'll have someone who's lost somebody they love. And you know they're heartbroken. As a minister, sometimes you get to see people at their hardest moments, right? And you see them break down. But then they get to the funeral home. Now, it's not true with everybody. We all mourn differently. But you'll see sometimes people you know are sad, but what do they do? They'll stand up and they'll wait and they'll talk to people and they'll greet them and they'll... It's almost like they're trying to be to be strong for them, right? For the people who are coming to visit with them. It's an amazing thing to watch. You just ever sit back and watch it. David's having to be really strong right now. And he does that very thing. Also, there's this attitude here of, can you and I be wrong in our lives? I am, right? Isn't it really about how we respond to correction? Who likes to be corrected? Who in here wouldn't love to believe every instinct, every action that you do, every word you say is the perfect right thing to do? Anybody in here not like to be like that? But the reality is what? I make mistakes. I mess up. Sometimes I need to be corrected. And it's really about how we respond to that. Can we put our pride aside long enough to see truth and to correct ourselves? David shows that here in chapter 19. We see David has now won, but does that mean everything goes back to the way it was before? All right, let's back up from a practical standpoint. What's going on in the nation of Israel? It's a broken nation right now. You just had a major coup attempt in this nation where you had the rightful king supplanted by his son and placed on the throne out of his own will. Was he the only one in this? Was it just him and a few followers? Was it? That's where I asked the question, and then somebody says, Yeah, I don't know.
Everybody seemed to like it.
Even the elders of the people went along with it. They bought into Absalom. They made him king. He didn't just make himself king. Now, he stole the hearts of the people, but they gave it to him. And so now Absalom's dead, but we kind of have a nation that's really divided. And so David's got to try to repair that, or God's going to try to repair that somewhat. We're going to note that maybe things don't get repaired very quickly. So David now, he's still not in Jerusalem. And I want you to note the end of verse 8. What does it say about Israel? So David's of what tribe, by the way? This is kind of important. What tribe is David? Anybody tell me? What tribe is he of? Remember, there's 12 tribes. He's of Judah. Now, Judah and Benjamin are located where in the nation of Israel? There's 12, like, you know, they're not states necessarily, but they're kind of like states, right? There's like 12 states in the nation of Israel. 10 of them are what you would call the northern portion. This is important. Remember this geography because it's going to play out. It's important to realize this. So you've got the kind of 10 in the north, and you've got 2 in the south. Who are the 2 in the south? Judah and Benjamin. Judah and Benjamin in the south, and then you've got the northern part. Now, later on, when the nation of Israel divides itself, we have the nation of Israel in the north, and we have the nation of Judah in the south. David is a Judite. Who does it say? What does it say about Israel at the end of verse 8? After the battle, what did they do? They went home. They fled. I think about the Civil War in America, right? So in the Civil War, we had really two sets, right, or two sections of our country. We had the North and the South. Now, after the war was over, what was, and really the major work of Abraham, Lincoln's life, was not the war, but it's what took place after the war. What, you may not remember what we call that period of time?
Reconstruction.
Because what are they rebuilding? The nation. Because really, there's this huge divide between the North and the South. And so a large part of Lincoln's, what remained of his presidency, and who was the vice president? He was the one that really took this on after. But he was to rebuild the nation, to bring both of those groups together. David's got a similar problem, and we'll note that in just a minute, but there's kind of an issue. So just keep that in mind. So Israel has fled back home. Now, verse 9, all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines." They're remembering what happened a long time ago when David first became king. Remember, he was a great warrior king. And so they remember that. And he saved us from the hand of the Philistines. Now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. But Absalom, whom, what?
We
appointed or anointed over us, is dead in battle. They got a problem. We got a problem. We got egg on our face. What do we do? So they say, "But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing the king back? Why don't you bring him back?" The big problem. How do you bring a king back that you have sent away? It's actually, think about this. This is a big political problem. How do you just bring him back? Imagine, you know, what if we had a president that falsely got put out of office, and later on it came out that he didn't do what he was accused of, the evidence came out, but we got him out of office, how do you put him back? You can't do that, right? Our Constitution wouldn't allow that. He'd have to go and run again. They've got a problem. And so they say, why don't we call him back? Verse 11, David is going to, as a good politician, going to play on that emotion. So he goes to, remember his guys, Zadok and Abiathar, the priest. Remember he left them in Jerusalem with the ark. Y'all remember that? Everybody remembers that, right? He left them there. And he said, say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his house when the word of all Israel has come to the king? What has Israel said? Now, note that identification, by the way. Just remember that. Key that away. Israel has already asked for him to come back. And they're like, David's like, Judah, where are you? Why haven't you called me back? All right, let's go on. You are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Then why then should you be the last to bring the king back? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone? Who's Amasa? Do you remember who he was? He was the commander of Absalom's armies. Remember, Absalom supplanted Joab because Joab went with David. And once you notice something David does here, he says, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of my army from now on in the place of Joab. What has David just done? This is politics, isn't it? Think about what he's just done. When Absalom supplanted David, he put Amasa in place of Joab. What has David said to him? He said, I'm going to execute you when I get back to town. David have the right to do that? Yes, he does. But what would be the possible outcome of that?
Have another rebellion.
More division, right? So David, trying to overcome that, says, you know what? Instead of Joab, you will now be commander of my army. Now, that didn't work out as good as maybe David hoped. But that's David's plan. He says, I'll make you commander over Joab. And Joab, it's interesting, we don't know Joab's reaction to that. Never says he got angry about it. But Joab's been very loyal to David. You remember Joab, well, we won't go there. But anyway, he's been very loyal to David. Verse 14, and he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah. Just like it says earlier that Absalom stole the hearts of the people. Notice the different wording here. Here it says David swayed or convinced the hearts of the people, of all the men of Judah, as one man. So they sent word to the king, return both you and all your servants. So the king came back to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and to bring the king over the Jordan. What's significant about the Jordan? Notice they met at the Jordan. Why at the Jordan? The Jordan was the southern boundary of Israel. That's where they crossed over to go to where? Jericho. They're sitting, he comes up to the Jordan, the nation comes to meet him. What's the significance of that? David didn't just go right back in Jerusalem, go get back on the throne. Why have this coronation? Or this welcome party. It's to show consolidation. We're all coming together here. We're all meeting at this common place. And so they meet there. While they're there, David then begins to pardon. Again, you go back to the Civil War. After the Civil War was over, what did Abraham Lincoln do? He began to give out pardons. The war's over. Let the war be over. And so he began to pardon people. What's his goal? To bring the people back together. Notice what goes on here. Verse 16, Shimei. Now who is he? Remember what he did? We noted this earlier. I didn't write this reference down, but remember, he's the guy that was throwing stones at David, saying, "You deserve this. God has repaid the blood on your head for what you did to the family of Saul." Remember, this is a man in the family of Saul. Remember, he was cursing David. David's man says, "Let's kill him." David said, "No, we're not going to do that. You leave him alone." David said, "Let's see if God doesn't repay me for the evil done to me." So now here is this same man. What's he done in verse 16? He hurried to come down. So he comes in a hurry to meet David. Well, what does he say? Well, he begs for forgiveness. Verse 18, the end of that verse, Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. He said to the king, "Let not my lord hold me guilty or remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. Do not let the king take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to come down to meet my lord the king." He's repenting, right? Now it's interesting, if you go back to where we were first introduced to Shimei, what does David say when they want to execute him? Do you remember? He says, what? He says, "Leave him alone, God." He is saying what God is telling him to say. So David, whether it's true or not, I'm assuming it is true, God actually inspired Shimei to do what he did. Well, how does David react this time? Again, Abishai says, "Let's kill him." Verse 21. He said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he has cursed the Lord's anointed?" Right? Did he deserve to be executed? The king probably had that power. He definitely had that power to do it. But David's response is what? Verse 23, "You shall not die." So he relents. He pardons him. And he really does nothing else to him. And so they go on their way. Well, he's got another matter to deal with. Mephibosheth. Who's Mephibosheth? Who? Jonathan's son, exactly. Jonathan's son. Jonathan's son who's handicapped, whose legs are crippled. So basically he has to wait on people to get him to go here. When David fled Jerusalem, what was Mephibosheth's reaction? He didn't come. He stayed. The text seems to indicate that he believed that Absalom maybe would restore some things to him or whatever it was going to be. But he didn't go. Now, what he'll tell David is, "I was tricked. I was misled on that." And it's interesting, the text notes, verse 24, that he had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes, from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. What does that seem to indicate? You can just, whatever you think, it's okay. What does it seem to indicate to you? Yeah, so what would you say that probably indicated about how you felt about David? I think it lends truth to what he said, that he really wanted to go with David. Either that, or he felt really guilty about not going. Either way you want to perceive that. Seems to indicate that to me. But what did David say to Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, the servant of Jonathan? Remember, Ziba is the one that introduced David to, or brought to David's attention, Mephibosheth. What does David say to Ziba initially? You're going to have all his things, all his property, all his holdings, everything. It's going to be yours. And David changes that a little bit when they meet. Verse 29, so after Mephibosheth has said, you know, you do to me what you think is right. I'm not, who am I to beg of your forgiveness? You brought me to eat at your table. And then in verse 29, David says, why speak any more of your affairs, right? This is under the bridge. We're going to let it go. I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land. All right, so David has kind of changed. He's relented. Initially, he told Ziba he was going to get all his possessions. Now he says, you know what? We'll divide up. Now, this is a big deal, isn't it? This doesn't just affect Mephibosheth or Ziba. This affects their entire family. We're not talking about a little one-room cottage up in the mountains. We're talking about huge land portions, property, probably servants. Lots of things are in this. Notice Mephibosheth's attitude about it. I think, again, speaking to his sincerity, he says to the king, oh, let him take it all. Talking about, give it all to Ziba, since my lord the king has come home safely. Now, I'm not sure what was the end of all of this. I don't know, did they divide it up between them, or did all of it get given to Ziba? But Ziba, you remember, showed great loyalty to David in his fleeing, unlike Mephibosheth's house. So, again, David pardons Mephibosheth. We'll stop here because his time's out. But there is a debt that David owes. He'll repay that. We'll go over that real quickly. Go ahead and read the rest of 19, and go ahead and read through chapter 24. There's some of this we'll go over really fast because it's I want to kind of move on to Bathsheba and Solomon and what goes on with that. Any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true for him personally, but to his family more broadly, it would have meant a lot more. So that's kind of the point. Like, it's not just affecting him. And I think it's interesting to go back and to consider God's prophecy to Saul. He said his family would lose everything. God's prophecy continuing to play itself out. The house of Saul. So, anyway, thank you all. Like I said, read 2 Samuel 19 through 24. We'll be ready to discuss that next week. The week after is the gospel meeting. Of course, we won't meet in this class, but we'll be in here to hear Brother Mays. Thank you so much.